Happy Valentine's Day, ghosts and ghouls. Welcome to another episode of Danica Raven's Bite-Sized Horror. This month I have a story for you with a family curse, a spectre and young lovers. So if you're sitting comfortably, we shall begin. This story is called The Grey Cavalier of Penterton Hall by Guy Boothby. Christmas at Penterton Hall was like the rite of matrimony, a thing not to be taken in hand wantonly or unadvisedly. It was a festive season, which few who had participated in it are ever likely to forget. In the first place, the old squire was not the sort of man to stand any nonsense. He invited you, meaning that you should have a good time while you were with him. He welcomed you with the same intention. He looked after your comfort and amusement from the day that you were entered his hospitable doors until you left them again. And if, when that sad moment arrived, you departed with the opinion that Christmas at Penterton was not what it had been described, well then, you did what no other man had been known to do before you, and deserved to suffer as such. Why, the mere sight of the squire's jolly red face was sufficient to make a man enjoy himself, to say nothing of his cheery voice and inexhaustible fund of anecdotes, which everyone had heard before, but which all longed to hear again. As a host, he was one man in a thousand, and when you come to his housekeeper and niece, pretty Winifred Dicey, well, all you can say, she is just one in a million. And I don't mind who knows I said so. How it came about that the squire had never married has never been properly explained. Between ourselves, however, I fancy there is some mystery in the matter. There are not wanting people, indeed, who assert that the squire and his brother both loved and wooed Winifred's mother, that the younger was successful, and that the squire, like the trump he always was, and always will be, acted up to his principles, held out his hand to his rival, and wished him joy. When 5 years later, Winifred's father met his death on the field of battle, and his wife died of a broken heart on receiving the news, he took the little orphan girl to live with him, and gave her every scrap of his great heart. No one will ever realise how much that couple loved each other, but many who have stayed at Penterton can hazard a very good guess. If you were to listen to the old squire, you would hear the most absurd stories about his darling. He would tell you how when she was only a tiny tot of 5, she would accompany him on his visit to the kennels and pick out old Rover and Rochester from 15 couple or more, and never cry or even whimper when the great beasts fawned about her and endeavoured to put their paws upon her shoulder and try to lick her face. He would tell you the most extraordinary stories about her prowess in the saddle, how, by gad, sir, she had ridden his own pet hunter, Nimrod, on a certain ever-to-be-remembered day when the hounds met at Pinkley Gorse and fairly floored the field, good sir. And if the telling happened to be at night, it's £1,000 to a sixpence that we'd order up another bottle of port, one of the very particular, by the way, and drink to the health of the sweetest maid who ever wore a habit. I don't think I should be very far wrong in saying that before she was 20, she'd never given the squire a moment's unhappiness. That, unfortunately, was to come. And it was the coming of that which constitutes this story. Needless to say, old Squire Dicey's niece was not likely to lack admirers. As a matter of fact, they flocked in from all directions until the squire began to think it would be wiser were he to issue orders that no male should be admitted within the gate without a written permission from himself. To the squire's great joy, however, they invariably went away disconsolate. How were they to know that Winifred's heart was already given, and as is so often the case, to the very man of all others of whom the squire was least likely to approve? Handsome, devil-may-care Dick Beverley, the ruined squire of Blixford, was a charming companion of irreproachable birth and manners. As a set-off, however, against these advantages, it's well known that he had squandered his patrimony, had been rusticated from Cambridge, and was, in consequence, the horror of virtuous mothers with marriageable daughters for many miles around. That he should have fallen in love with pretty Winifred Dicey seemed only natural, for they all did. But that she should have reciprocated his affections and have promised to be his wife seemed to be out of the proper order of things. However, it was a fact, and one that was likely to cause a considerable amount of trouble for all parties concerned in the near future. One day, the young man screwed up his courage and rode over to the hall for an interview with the squire. The latter listened to him patiently and then spoke his mind. "Impossible," he said. "Quite impossible. What you ask is out of the question." "You mean, I suppose, that you've heard all sorts of things about me, that I am hard up and have been a bit wild?" "I don't deny it. But if I give you my word that I will reform, and that I will not marry your niece until I have set the old place on its feet again, will you accept that as sufficient proof of my love and sanction our engagement?"
"I can sanction nothing," the squire answered. "I can only repeat that what you ask is impossible."
"Entreaty will not move you."
"Nothing will move me," the other replied. "My mind is made up."
Seeing that it was useless to say anything further, Dick bade him goodbye, and that night, at a stolen meeting in a wood behind the hall, informed Winifred of what had occurred at the interview. Some meddlesome person told the squire of the meeting, and he spoke to his niece upon the subject. She confessed her love and vowed that without young Beverley, life for her would be a blank. Then the squire lost his temper and said things for which I can assure you he was sorry afterwards. The result was a misunderstanding and a tiff, which on the squire's part took the form of a letter to the young man in question, warning him to have no intercourse with the lady in question under the pain of his, the squire's, severest displeasure. In less than a month, he'd come to hate the young man, as he had never hated anyone in his life before. His very name was an abomination to him. What was more, he shepherded his niece more closely than ever, and seldom allowed her out of his sight. In consequence, the lovers were not permitted to meet, and Winifred began to look pale and heavy-eyed, and life at the hall was the reverse of cheerful. There could be no doubt that the affair was causing the dear old squire a great amount of misery. He was not the same man at all. He had no desire to be unjust, nor had he considered young Beverley a suitable match. Would he have stood in the way for a moment? As a matter of fact, he did not know much about him personally, and what little he did know was told him by busybodies, who doubtless had their own reasons for desiring to prove the young fellow a villain of the deepest dye. On one pitiful occasion, he was driven into saying something which, at any other time, he would rather have cut his tongue out than have uttered. When he left the drawing room where the interview had taken place and returned to his own room, Gregory, his ancient butler, informed him that Mrs. Gibbs, the housekeeper, desired to speak to him.
"Send her in, send her in," said the squire a little sharply, for he was not in the humour for domestic worries. Then to himself he added, "What on earth can the woman have to say to me?"
It turned out that Mrs. Gibbs's errand was of a peculiar nature. A domestic crisis was imminent, and chaos reigned in the servants' hall. Put into plain words, it amounted to this: the Grey Cavalier, the famous Penderton ghost, who was known to pace the quadrangle at the back of the house when any great trouble was about to happen to the family, had made his appearance on three occasions of late, and had been plainly seen by a footman, a lady's maid, and a housemaid. The footman had been reduced to a state of collapse.
the females to a condition of idiocy. According to their statements, he was standing in the moonlit quadrangle at the time, gazing sadly at the house. Then, with a wave of his hand, he had disappeared in the direction of the chapel, back to his tomb behind the altar. They indignantly denied any possibility of there having been a mistake. They had seen his great grey boots, his love locks, his lace ruffles, and his grey beaver hat, and, as a result, nothing could induce them to stay after their month was up, or to cross the quadrangle after dark. Your maids are a pack of fools, and the footman is something worse, cried the irritable squire. Not, however, without a thrill of satisfaction, as he thought of the story he would now be able to tell concerning the famous spectre. However, he sent Mrs. Gibbs about her business, and then sat down at his writing table to pen a letter to his best friend in the world. He told him of his difficulty regarding young Beverley, of his niece's state of health, and asked his advice. 2 days later, an answer arrived, and in it, the old colonel promised to do his best to exorcise the fatal passion that had taken possession of the pretty Winifred. And for this reason, he would spend Christmas at the Hall, and bring as many of his young friends as he could collect with him. Now, if the colonel knew one eligible young man, he knew a dozen. The respectability, wealth, and culture of whom he was prepared to guarantee with his life. What was more, he knew half a dozen girls of transcendent beauty and accomplishments, who would act as excellent foils and would put Winifred upon her mettle. With such a force at his back, it would be strange indeed, he argued, if they were unable to rout Beverley and drive him from the field never to return. Although Winifred protested against such an invasion, the necessary invitations were dispatched and in due course accepted by the parties concerned. In the meantime, Beverley was supposed to be in London, and Winifred's heart was about as sad as it was possible for the heart of a maiden to be. Indeed, the only person who seemed to be enjoying the festive season at all was the grey ghost of Sir Michael, who, within the previous month, had been twice seen on his accustomed promenade. The result was so upsetting from a domestic point of view that instead of venerating him, as he had been brought up to do, the squire began to look upon his supernatural relative as a nuisance second only to Beverley himself. Though he protested that it was all fancy, and those who declared that they had seen the apparition must have dreamt it, I have an idea that he was no more disposed to pay a visit to the quadrangle at night than were the maidservants themselves. What was more, he confined his visits to the chapel to daylight, and anxiously looked forward to the time when his visitors should arrive, and by so doing, created a diversion. At last, the great day arrived, and the stables found their time fully taken up by meeting trains and conveying guests to the hall. Holly and mistletoe decorated the corridors, great logs spluttered in the fires, and all was gaiety and merrymaking. The squire, to all appearances, was jollity itself. He had a warm welcome for each new arrival, a joke for the men, and well, if truth must be told, a kiss for the girls. The seeds of some promising flirtations were sown at afternoon tea, and by the time the dressing gong sounded for dinner, all was as merry as a marriage bell. Indeed, it was not until late in the evening, just as the bedroom candlesticks made their appearance, that a damper was cast upon the spirit of the party. Then one young lady, more courageous than the rest, turned to the squire and asked if it was true, as her maid had told her, that the grey cavalier had been making his appearance rather too frequently of late. The squire gazed at her in amazement. The temerity of the young lady staggered him. As a rule, the grey cavalier was never mentioned, save with bated breath, and never, by any chance, within an hour of bedtime. He noted also that Winifred's hand trembled, and that she turned deathly pale. He remembered the fact that she had always entertained a great fear of the spectre, and his warm old heart went out to the girl for that reason. And perhaps, if truth must be told, for still another. He was well aware that she loved young Beverley, and he was filled with sorrow that it should have fallen to his lot to have been compelled to differ with her as to the merits of the man of her choice. However, as the matter stood, it was impossible for him to draw back, and accordingly, he was forced not only to let her suffer, but to suffer himself at the same time. He thought of this when his guests had departed to their various bedrooms, and he and Winifred stood at the bottom of the great staircase, bidding each other good night. His old heart was troubled, and it was made none the easier when Winifred clasped her arms about his neck and said, "Dear old uncle, you must try to think better of me. You've been so good to me, and I have repaid your kindness so poorly. You'll never know how grateful I am to you for it all." "Pooh, pooh," said the squire. "You mustn't talk nonsense, little girl. Run away to bed and come down to breakfast in the morning with the roses in your cheeks." He noticed that the girl heaved a heavy sigh as she turned to go upstairs, and though he could not understand the reason, he was even more upset than before. He began to wonder whether young Beverley might not, with encouragement, turn out better than he expected, and if he should give him the chance. This led him to think of his dear dead brother and of Winifred's mother, both of whom at that very moment were perhaps watching him and sighing at his treatment of their orphan child. He accordingly heaved another heavy sigh, more doleful than the first, and accompanied old Gregory on his locking up operations with an even sadder heart than ever. He had not retired to his couch more than a couple of hours, however, a sleepless couple, by the way, when the unmistakable click of an iron latch in the quadrangle below reached his ears. What could it mean? He sprang out of bed and hastened to the window. He was only just in time, for there, crossing the open space, was a tall, grey figure, habited in the costume of a cavalier. It was a frosty night, and the moon shone so cold and clear that every detail of his costume was plainly observable, even to the love locks and the long grey boots. For the first time in his life, the squire was looking upon the apparition whose appearance was supposed to foretell death or disaster to his family. Suddenly, however, something struck him as being somewhat singular, and when he had seen the figure disappear by the small door into the chapel on the other side, he left the window and began to dress. Then, taking a candle, he departed from his chamber and set off on a tour of inspection. The house was in total darkness and as silent as the grave. He did not hesitate, however. He pushed on, past the billiard room, past his own study, until he reached the door on the long corridor, which opened onto the chapel itself. Once there, he blew out the light and softly opened the door. Creeping in, he found the worshipping place of his ancestors in total darkness, save where it was lighted by the moonbeams which entered through the lancet windows on the further side. The marble effigies of his long-departed relatives showed stiff and dark above their tombs, but in the centre of the aisle stood two figures whom he clearly recognised. One was the Grey Cavalier, the other Winifred, his niece. From his place of vantage, he could plainly overhear all that they were saying. Their conversation ran somewhat as follows.
"Are you sure, Dick dear, that you mean what you say?" whispered the girl, who, by the way, had her arms round the cavalier's neck.
"Quite sure," the ghost of the Grey Cavalier replied. "The old man loves you. And though he doesn't trust me, I'll be dashed if I'll be such a mean cad as to carry you off and break his heart, while there's a chance of winning him round to our way of thinking. He'll like me all the better when he sees how hard I'm trying to be worthy of you. And on the other hand, just think what life here would be to him without you, little woman.
I wish, Dick dear, he knew you as you are. He has only heard the things evil, disposed people have said about you. He doesn't know how good you really are."
"Not very good, I'm afraid," the other replied. "If I've improved a bit of late, I owe it all to you and your gentle influence. But I'm trying to pull up, and that, at least, is something. And now I must be off. You say there is a ball on Boxing Night? So I suppose I must wait until another night to see you? Cannot you come then? What? The Grey Cavalier make his appearance on such a festive occasion? If you think you could manage to slip away for a quarter of an hour, I might try. I'm sure I could. At any rate, I'll do my best. But isn't it a great risk to run? Risk? Not a bit of it. In that case, the spectre will be seen at midnight precisely. The squire waited to hear no more, but softly opening the door, picked up his candle and fled to his own room to think over all he had heard. So far as that particular night was concerned, his rest was not likely to be disturbed. In the morning, however, he was a different being. He'd come to an understanding with himself, and he was brighter in consequence. His face at breakfast said as much. Never had such a Christmas day been known at Penderton Hall. The squire was like a new man. He proposed everyone's health at lunch and conducted himself like an amiable lunatic during the remainder of the day. Boxing Day arrived in due course and discovered no change in his condition. Winifred scarcely knew what to make of his behaviour. Poor child. The dance of that evening presented no chance of enjoyment for her. Before dusk, the squire summoned the colonel and two or three of the young men to his study and kept them there for upwards of an hour. It was to be observed that when they emerged, they seemed to be staggering under the weight of a great responsibility. Of all the balls that have ever been at Penderton, that of which I'm about to attempt a description, will always be considered the most remarkable. One of the most noticeable features was the fact that shortly before midnight, the colonel and the young men aforesaid disappeared from the ballroom. Winifred followed their example a little later. The squire also was not to be seen. The clock in the belfry had scarcely struck 12 before the door of the ballroom opened and the squire entered, escorting his niece. She was very pale and seemed much put out about something. Almost at the same moment, the door at the further end of the room opened and a singular figure, attired after the manner of the reign of the first Charles, entered, escorted by the colonel and his stalwart aides. Winifred, on seeing him, uttered a cry and would have run towards him, but that the squire held her back. "Ladies and gentlemen," the dear old fellow began, looking around at those present as he spoke, "all of you have heard of the famous Grey Cavalier of Penderton Hall. You will in the future be able to say that you have seen him face to face, and that he is not so terrible as you have been led to suppose. At last, the spectre has been laid by the heels, and in saying that, I have to make a confession to you. My dear friends, I feel that I am very much to blame. For a long time past, I have listened to the voices of public opinion and refused to hear that of love. The first I am about to put on one side. Upon the other, for the future, I will pin my faith. Mr. Beverley, you have played me a trick in the manner of the Grey Cavalier, but I am sure if I give you my darling's hand, you will show me that my confidence has not been misplaced. From this moment, we will let bygones be bygones. And now," here he turned to the musicians, "play up, let us have some music." Of course, we all knew the story of the unhappy love affair, and we were all, or at any rate, those of us who were married, delighted at the denouncement. Winifred's face was a picture to see, and as for the ghost, well, if ever the Grey Cavalier was half as happy as he appeared to be as he whirled his lady love over the ballroom floor, he must have been as jolly a spectre as could have been found throughout the length and breadth of the land. They are to be married in 3 months' time, and the squire has commanded our presence at the ceremony. Everyone agrees that Beverley is a reformed character, and if he is at all grateful for his happiness, he must surely reflect that he owes it to the lucky thought which induced him to take upon himself the role of the Grey Cavalier of Penderton Hall. I hope you enjoyed the story. Thanks again for listening. And don't forget to like, share and subscribe. And be sure to send in your recommendations and your short horror stories. Thank you.
Hosted by Danica Raven. Directed and edited by James Bailey. A Silver Zephyr Media production. www.silverzephyrmedia.com. Facebook at DanicaRaven26 or at Silver Zephyr Media to send your own stories into the show. Video version of this story also available on the YouTube channel Danica Raven's Bite Size Horror.